Steve, thanks very much. Hi, everybody. It's Bill and it's Wendy. Welcome to the show. Because it is September 11th, I think we'd be cheating ourselves if we didn't kind of address the issues of what took place 17 years ago. 17 years ago today, which is amazing as I think about it. It's one of those things, and I've told you this before, Wendy, there are certain events in your life that seem like they happened 1,000 years ago, but they also seem like they happened a week ago.
Yep.
You know?
September 11th, 2001, 7:45 a.m. Chicago time, a plane hits the World Trade Center. Many people, I know I thought this, oh, look at this small plane that hit the World Trade Center. And then 18 minutes later, a second plane came in and hit the other tower, and that's when we knew we were under attack.
Yep.
And we're going to talk to Tom Makaitis right now, professor of history at DePaul University, a terrorism expert. Tom, I hate you can't say happy 9/11, but welcome to 9/11.
Hello, how are you doing?
It's just one of those days that truly we didn't know what to do on today, but it's one of those days that people still want to talk about. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, there are certain events. They don't necessarily change the course of history, but they become, you know, the defining moments in our lives. We talk about time fixing, the ability everybody knows exactly where they were when they realized what was occurring. So, yeah, there's no question. And how we live our lives has to some degree changed as a result of 9/11 in ways that, you know, when I always think about it, it's sort of sobering to think that my freshman students this year have no real memory of the event. It's already history for them.
And do you cover that? Because I know there was quite some time in the elementary school that my kids, they kind of mentioned it, but it was not really discussed in the curriculum.
That's an interesting thing. I mean, I was very active, obviously, in covering 9/11 when it occurred. But the attitude of a lot of parents was, let's not frighten our kids and not talk about it. And I spoke at my son's junior high school, and I asked, how many of you are afraid to travel? And all these hands shot up. And the message of that is, if you don't talk to your kids about even things that are this upsetting, then what they pick up is fear, and they pick up anxiety, and that's actually that's less constructive. I think to some degree, though, covering it at least maybe fading a bit. You know, we're getting 17, 18, 20 will probably be a big one, but at some point, you know, this will be a footnote in history.
You know, Tom, that's an interesting thing you say, because I've been thinking about this. If you are younger older than 30, you know, it's seared in our minds and we experienced it. But if you now are younger than 30 years old, you would have been 13 at the time. It's something that you've only heard about during your life. It's less something that you've experienced. Yeah. So it's our country's changing in that way.
And you also take for granted things that were an adjustment for us. I mean, like all of us can remember when you could walk your loved one all the way to the gate and say goodbye as they stepped on the plane, quite literally. Now, of course, that's impossible. And this has just simply become the new normal for us. And we don't really, in some ways that's healthy. We don't really get twitched out about it. I mean, remember that first year we were going from orange to yellow and back and forth in the alerts, and all we were doing was driving ourselves crazy.
Yeah.
Tom, go back with us 17 years ago, right after the second plane hit the towers. There was so much speculation as to exactly what was going on. Nobody knew exactly what was going on, and nobody knew exactly who was responsible. And as you watch television, you had a lot of theories being thrown out there. When did we realize exactly who was responsible?
That's interesting. Wendy mentioned the kid, you know, it's a small, that's exactly what happened with me. I was taking my son to school and he goes, Dad, it must be a terrorist attack. He knows what I do. And he was about, you know, 11 or 12. And I said, no, it's some poor person rammed his Piper Cub into it. And as soon as I saw the second plane, we knew it was a terrorist attack. I think pretty quickly it was possible to connect the dots to say, wait a second, there was the embassy bombing. There's been a threat from Al-Qaeda since, you know, the fatwa in 96 and again in 98. That they put together pretty quickly and determined who was responsible.
That moment, that second plane hit, is when everything changed. You just felt like you were punched in the stomach. The coverage was wall to wall. I remember watching the footage because, as Justin Kaufman mentioned earlier, there was no social media. There was no Twitter. So we were just trying to consume everything we could. And there were so many unanswered questions. But I'll never forget the footage they had, and they kept showing of people jumping off that building. I'll never forget that. Mm.
Me either. I got home, realized second plane, and immediately got phone calls, went into WGN, and didn't come back for 13 hours. And exactly right. They were holding hands, jumping out the window, and none of us could, to avoid burning to death, which is a more horrible way to go. I don't think any of us did that. And yeah, it was constant coverage. And I don't think people realized too, there were no teleprompters. People were literally just going along. I mean, they had them, but they weren't using them. For the most part, it was bringing in people to discuss it and a lot of speculation, trying to make sense of the unthinkable, because this was not supposed to happen to the United States.
Tom, nearly every question I ask you could start with these words, but in retrospect, what could we or should we have seen? Is there anything, were there any red flags, any telltale signs of what was to come?
Yeah, the 9/11 report, you know, had a chapter saying all the indicators were blinking red. But I think what we had was what we call strategic warning, which means, you know, the same with Pearl Harbor. It's like, okay, the Japanese are planning an attack somewhere in the Pacific. You know, it's a big place. If you go back, you could reconnect the dots and say, okay, now I see that there's a pattern there. But that pattern sometimes doesn't become clear. Till afterwards, any of us who have had family members with a substance abuse issue, part of when you get, you know, when they get help and you get the counseling, will go, oh yeah, my gosh, I didn't realize there were all these warning signs. Now I see. But when you're enmeshed in events and you're enmeshed in the times in which you live, it's not always that clear. And I was asked, you know, was President Bush responsible? No. Could we have done better? Did we need to pay attention? You know, yeah, we did. We missed some things. But then again, it's understandable to some degree how we missed them.
Do you think to some extent, because nothing like that had ever happened to us before, thankfully, that we were... You know where I'm going.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. But you know exactly what I'm saying. The mere fact that nothing even remotely close to that had ever happened to us meant that we weren't looking for it.
Yeah, a lot of security failures, and really failures in life in general, are what we call failures of imagination. In other words, I never imagined it could happen here. And that's a human thing. It's understandable. We get comfortable. We get used to taking our security for granted. And, you know, we'd had devastating attacks, the USS Cole in Aden Harbor. We'd had the attack on the embassy bombings, but those were still overseas. You know, and it didn't occur to us. And even at the time, it was an absurdity of screening. And I remember this. I did, before, doing this, I did a lot of work on the Northern Ireland campaign. So I got used to being screened going overseas. And if I was in the British Isles, I got checked even more just by virtue of their security measure. But, you know, it's like, no, we don't worry about domestic flights because it just doesn't happen here. Obviously, that, you know, was proved tragically incorrect.
I was thinking about that on the way in today. If George W. feels any kind of guilt or anything, it's not his fault. I know it's not. And no one really blamed him. I mean, in the aftermath of 9/11, what was so touching to me is we all came together as a country, and I feel like that's dissipating a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think there was a very strong sense of pulling together and so on. And, you know, it's one thing to say, and again, you go back to the personal example of your life. If you look backwards, we can all say, gee, how come I didn't see this? I could have done this better. Why was I so foolish and this kind of thing? But that's very different to say than that was a major, you know, someone willfully ignored or was just oblivious to what was going on. That isn't the case. They were telling you this morning, it's real interesting, the whole issue of security briefings. Frequently, the president gets a lot of security briefings, but his briefer that morning did not even mention terrorism. So, you know, and they deal with a complicated threat environment. So it's easy to be the armchair quarterback on, you know, Monday morning, but not quite as easy when you're kind of wrapped up in things.
We're talking to Tom Mikitas, professor of history at DePaul University, terrorism expert. We'll continue this conversation in just a little bit. Stick around, Bill and Wendy, WGN.
It's 9/11, and we are speaking with Dr. Tom Mikaitis, professor of history at DePaul University, also a terrorism expert. And when we did find out that Al-Qaeda was responsible, which there was a lot of questions, a lot of questions at the very beginning, is Al-Qaeda still working?
Yeah, it's interesting you asked that question because I was asked to write a piece, a short article for an online journal about the what are called the Abbottabad files. At the time Osama bin Laden was killed, we had a bonanza of intelligence information that was picked up. It took some time to translate it. The evidence suggests that even though they've been eclipsed by ISIS, they're still there, and there's some evidence they're actually regrouping. You know, and the other thing to keep in mind, too, is that, you know, it's the ideology that is most pernicious. These groups come and go, but I fully expect there to be an Al-Qaeda 2.0 or an ISIS 2.0 or a something else. Well, that's the bad news. The good news is terrorism is a chronic, persistent problem, much like organized crime. It is not an existential threat, you know, much as the fear is exaggerated. It, you know, I don't see it destroying us in our way of life.
What is, I know this will sound like a strange question, but I seriously mean this. What is the working relationship amongst terrorist groups like those two? Do they just coexist? Do they get along? Are they at odds? How do they feel about each other?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was just talking about this briefing I do with a counterterrorism program through the U.S. government, and I was telling the students, foreign students and so on, that in fact, if you take a look, there's a map, the mapping has been done of terrorist attacks since over the last 45 years. Overwhelmingly, they're connected to regional and local conflicts, but they latch on. I mean, Boko Haram in Nigeria is very much involved in a struggle, you know, a north-south struggle within Nigeria, but it has sworn allegiance to the Islamic State. So we go, oh my gosh, international terrorism. You know, Al-Shabaab in Somalia and various other groups are in fact really focused on local power struggles, local issues, but they share a common ideology. So they will cooperate, they may share assets to a limited extent, but it's not the case that all of them are interested in what Al-Qaeda called the far enemy, which is us, who mainly are targeted because we interfere with their efforts to build their Islamic you know, state run by Sharia in Muslim countries primarily. That's why we got attacked on 9/11. Not because they're interested in getting rid of us per se, but they wanted to get us out of what they saw as their sphere of influence.
In your opinion, Tom, could this happen again?
Yeah, it could. I think we have gotten a lot more savvy in terms of, for example, the target hardening. You know, airports are always a worry, but they're less of a worry than they were. But I was on a couple of weeks ago talking about Lollapalooza. Since 2006, when Lashkar-e-Taiba hit Mumbai with a team of 10 people and did, you know, serious damage and killed over 150 people, venues are becoming the new target. The good thing is, for lack of, again, a better, if you want to call it a silver lining, I don't know that it would shock us to the degree that 9/11 did. I think, you know, we've been down the road before. It would not be good, but I think we'd dust ourselves off and recover. The other thing that has to be said, too, and this was a big issue of 9/11, it's a big issue now, is we have to be very, very careful of, you know, condemning large groups of people for the behavior of a few fanatics. That was a real worry after 9/11, you know, an uptick in anti-Muslim activity and so on. And we're seeing that again. That's a concern. You know, right now I'm far more worried about extremism on the far right, the white nationalist movement and so on, than I am about ISIS. I'm actually working on a book on that, on those two threats and putting them in a healthy perspective.
We don't have a lot of time at all, Tom. I'm just curious. After the events of 9/11, there was a fear in the country that this was going to be the new normal, that this could possibly happen a lot more often, and it hasn't. And that's not just because of luck, that because there's a lot of men and women out there who are devoting their lives to stopping this. Who do we thank for that?
Oh, you can thank anybody who has served their country in the military, the police, the FBI, the intelligence community. You can't thank them because they won't identify that that's what they do.
Yeah.
But they certainly deserve the credit. Our international partners are a huge part of it, but it's a group effort. The other is an informed citizenry, you know, and so on. But I have great respect for everybody who's involved in this long struggle. And it's not going to go away, but it's ceasing to be the preoccupation it once was. That's a good thing.
And Bill and I were talking about this off the air. Jules and Gédéon Naudet, two French brothers that were in New York City at the time of September 11th. They made this amazing documentary that I feel like I'm going to watch again tonight. I've seen it several times, but it really is an amazing piece of work, which really hits you right where it hurts.
Yeah. There's some speculation Al-Qaeda hit the towers with a delay between the two flights because they wouldn't be sure of TV coverage. That French crew was there filming something else and got footage we wouldn't otherwise have had.
It's pretty amazing. It's worth a watch. And you can just, I don't know the name of it, but you can Google French Brothers 9/11 documentary and it'll come right up. Thank you so much for remembering this day in history. We really appreciate talking to you, Tom.
Have a nice day.
Thanks, Tom. Tom Makaitis, professor of history at DePaul University and terrorism expert.